Throughout the course of this, I will probably end up talking about the finances, because the finances have been a huge issue for us. When we got here, my husband was unemployable. He was not a college graduate. When he got sober, he got a job in retail making minimum wage. I still am a professional woman, made a lot more money than he did. And I had this huge fear of financial insecurity. And throughout the course of our marriage, we've struggled with the finances. I've struggled with letting go of some of them. I'm holding on for dear life. This finances give me security. He has struggled with learning to be financially responsible. And so we've been through this, we've been through years of trying to find that balance. And what ended up happening for us was it started off probably at year 1.5, 2 years when he was sober, and he said, I need to learn to be financially responsible. And I went, no, you don't. I'll handle this for you. You don't need to learn how to do this. But he got a little credit card, and within a month he maxed out the credit card. And I'm like, how does that happen? And he's like, there's got to be a mistake. And we went through it. And my husband is not a stupid man. My husband is actually very intelligent, but it's just the practical application. He'd never looked at credit card bill, and he said, my God, that adds up quickly. Yes, it does. So we paid that off because I don't like having debt. A couple years later, I need to learn to be financially responsible. Same thing, racked up the bill. Within about 5 years, we got to the place where we had, I was giving him an allowance, but I was checking, and he had a credit card, and I was checking the credit card every single day. And whenever he bought something, I'd call him up, didn't matter where he was, work, AA meeting, didn't matter where it was, and I'd accost him. What'd you buy at so-and-so? What'd you spend $5.79 at the Books a Million store? And his response to me was always, I'm sorry. And I was operating from a place of fear. He was feeling like I was, I was actually checking up on him. And we couldn't come together on it. So what my sponsor suggested that we do was we open a bank account for him and that I don't look at it. And we did, but I was depositing an allowance in it to him every month. He made the mistake of giving me the password. And the very first time I deposited the money, I went right into the account and checked it. And I called him up and I said, you got to change the password. He said, I don't care. And I said, I do. I can't keep doing this. You got to change the password. And I know I can't keep doing it. So change the password. So he did. So I didn't have access to his accounts, which was a good thing for me. But I will tell you what happened is I started noticing my husband. One of the things you guys taught me to do was learn all I could learn about the disease of alcoholism so that I would know what I was living with. And I'm paying attention to my husband, and he's going to meetings and he's got a sponsor, but there's something not quite right with my husband. And what I was discovering was things were appearing in our house that could not possibly appear on his allowance. The thing I usually talk about is the big giant gun safe. And I mean, the gun safe was so big it would not fit in the house that was in the garage. And I discovered the gun safe when I drove in the garage then one day, and there it was. And I was like, wow, that is a big gun safe. And I am not stupid. And I knew that if there was a gun safe, there were probably guns in the safe. And so I'm taking that to my sponsor. I'm occasionally saying things to my husband like, wow, that's a really nice gun safe. And he said, yeah, I bought it on layaway. I adore my husband. I love my husband. He is my best friend on the planet. But my husband, prior to about 2 years ago, had never bought anything on layaway ever in his life. He was Mr. Instant Gratification. So I knew my husband was lying to me. I knew something was going on. I didn't know what it was. But the difference now was I was talking to my sponsor about it instead of talking to him about it. And I was going to her and saying, something's not quite right. And she said to me, you can interrupt the process if you would like in order to make yourself feel better, but he will never get where he needs to go. Are you willing to do that today? And I was not willing to do that today. For 2 years, one day at a time, I did not confront my husband. And what ended up happening was my husband came to me and said, I need to be rigorously honest with you. Oh, joy. I love it when he says that. And he said, I've gotten us into some credit card debt. And I said, being the spiritual giantess that I was, what do you mean us? Right? And we sat down on the couch and I said, well, honey, it's only money. What are you willing to do different? And that was true. At the moment, I was actually a spiritual giantess. And in that moment, it's only money. What are you willing to do different? And I'd like to say that I held on to that, but I didn't. Because I started thinking and I started getting scared and I started getting afraid. And what ended up happening is we went to an Al-Anon conference in Birmingham, Alabama. I hosted the Al-Anon speaker. It happened to be that same woman whose set of tapes I'd gotten, Kathy from Cincinnati. Spent the weekend with her. I was on cloud nine, Al-Anon everywhere. Now I will tell you this. When I first started talking about this, Kent was saying things like, I don't like it when you tell them how much it was. I'm like, well, my people need to know how much it is because they're all sitting there wondering how much it is. Your people probably don't care, but my people do. And so I've always shared that within 2 years, my husband got his $42,000 in credit card debt. And I was at an AA meeting conference one day talking about that. And he was sitting in the audience with some other AA member. And the dude sitting next to him said, dude, that's nothing. Fist bump. And I thought, you people are so wrong. There's just something so wrong with you people. But for me, it was $42,000 is a lot of money. But I was really great on that day. And we'd come back from this Al-Anon conference, and I opened the mail, and Kent had bought $32 symphony tickets to take me to the symphony. And I turned into a screaming crazy woman. I lost it. I can't believe you spent this money without checking with me, blah, 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 screaming, 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 screaming. And my husband, God bless my husband, calm, cool, collected, said to me, I am not willing to live like this with you micromanaging every dime I spend. And I thought to myself, the key word there being thought, how dare you? After everything I've lived with, you're not willing to live like this? I didn't say any of that. I had just taken up running to lose some weight, and I said, I'm going to go run. And I got my shoes on, and I was running down the main street where we live, and I'm talking to the God of my understanding, having done the prayer and meditation and asking for him to express himself in our group conscience. And I said, you got to do something about this money. You got to help me. I got to do something. I don't know what I'm going to do with this. And that's the only other time I've heard a voice as clear as bell in my head. And the voice said, either you're in the marriage or you're not. It's either your debt together or it's not. Make a decision. And I made the decision that day that I was in my marriage with both feet. I was going to be a part of this marriage. That's that idea of I gathered together for mutual aid. I've made the decision I'm in this relationship, but that is my decision. We've gone through the finances. We paid all that money off. He had to do a lot of stuff different. I will probably circle back around to that because that's been the main issue throughout our relationship. But I will tell you what happened that day was the decision I made that I am in this relationship. I am not today. I am not willing to walk away from it. Now, he might make that decision, and that's his decision. But as long as I'm practicing these traditions, I am in this relationship because I choose to be in this relationship, I'm going to stay. Now, I'll tell you, a couple years ago, I can't even tell you what was going on. But we got into an argument. Kent and I got into an argument about something. We rarely argue, but we'd gotten into an argument about something. And he came to me and he said, I think we need to split up. And I said, what? He said, I just think I need to leave. I think it'd be easier if I left. I think I just need to get an apartment and go. And what I said was, wow, that would make me very sad if that is what you feel like you need to do. I'd ask if you've talked to anybody about this. No, not going to talk to anybody about it. And I said, all right, well, perhaps we can think about it for a little bit. But if that's what you think you need to do, we can sit down and talk about that. And that really was my reaction. And he went off and he came back and he said, what would it look like? And I said, well, what would it look like? You'd have to get an apartment. We wouldn't be able to retire. Who would get the dog? Blah, 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 blah. He said, well, I'm going to think about it. And I'm like, all right. And he came back and he said, I don't really want to leave. And I said, that's great because I don't really want you to leave. I love you and I'd like us to be married. And just because we had an argument doesn't mean the relationship has to end. And not so long ago, probably in the spring when we walk Ragnar every weekend. There's a university close by and we walk out there back on the trails back there. And he said to me, I'd like to make an amends to you. And I was like, all right, for what? He said, you remember when I said I thought I needed to go? I'm like, oh yes, I remember when you said that. Vividly remember that actually. He said, I have no idea why I said that, but it was so cruel and it was so hurtful and I should never have said that to you. And I make a commitment to you that I'm not going to do that again. I have no idea where that came from. And I was able to very graciously accept that amends and tell him, yeah, it did hurt. But if that was what he felt like he needed to do, I'd support that decision. And we have an incredible marriage today. I'm so grateful that Al-Anon gave me the opportunity and taught me how to respond as opposed to react. To not be defensive, to not hit back, But you know, this goes back to me practicing these traditions about me being willing to be in the relationship and to allow him to be where he needs to be. My sole purpose at this point is to bring the best me I can to the table. Years ago, Kent said, you know, I work on me, Corey works on her, and the relationship works itself out. The problem comes in is when Corey works on me or I work on Corey, or God forbid we work on the relationship. And that's very true. As long as I am focused on bringing the best me to the table and doing my part, I trust God, I trust my program, I trust his program, I trust his God, I trust sponsors, I trust how far we have come. And I have a lot of experience upon which to base that trust, that if I am willing to do my part, all will be well. So that brings me to tradition 4. Each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting another group or Al-Anon or AA as a whole. All right, autonomous. What does that mean? It means my husband gets to be my husband. My husband gets to be who he is. And we get to have different opinions, and we get to do things differently. I have got a note here that says, I get to say it once. There's a reading from Courage to Change, January 29th. That says, I get to say it once. If I've said it more than one time, I'm probably trying to control. My sponsor made me cross out the word probably. She said, you are trying to control it. So you need to be sure you're communicating what you want to communicate, because you only get to say it once. And here's the other thing. My approval is not required for my acceptance of something. What that brings me to is this idea that my husband has interests that I don't understand. And I don't have to understand it. We live in Montgomery, Alabama. My husband is former military. He loves weapons. He absolutely loves weapons. Me, not so much. Not a big weapons kind of gal. But that's him. That's who he is, right? I don't have to understand that. But because he is autonomous, he gets to make decisions about whether or not we spend some of our money on weapons that are his interest, right? And that's where my approval is not required for it. But where we have come over the past years and how this has played out in our life is the very first weapon my husband bought, he'd gone out, he didn't tell me about it. That was a pattern in the finances is he would buy stuff and then come home and tell me about it. And I would say to him, I want to have a voice. You're spending our money. I want to feel like an active participant, right? And I meant that when I said it, but the ulterior motive was I wanted the veto. I said, I want to be part of the discussion. And so he would come to me and he'd say, I found this particular weapon. I really would like to get this. And I would say, do we need it? And he would say, that's hate speech. It's not about whether or not we need it. It's about what I want. And I had to come to a place and begin to understand that he gets to make decisions I don't necessarily like, that I am not in charge of the decisions. When my sponsor and I did the Reaching for Personal Freedom workshop, as we were going through the traditions, if you go back through and you look at my answers for almost all the traditions, somewhere in every one of those traditions, I will have written, I am not in charge. I am not in charge. I am not in charge. When you get to the concepts, what you will see I have written is hire professionals. Hire professionals, hire professionals, because I cannot do it all by myself. But if I love my husband and I have to let him be who he is, he gets to make decisions and I don't have to take those decisions personally. He is not buying weapons at me. He is not doing it to annoy me. He's doing it because it's something he likes. It's something that interests him. I remember very early on getting an assignment from my sponsor, and there's going to be a spoiler alert here. If your sponsor gives you an assignment, there's usually more than one part to it, just FYI. So I was talking to my sponsor and saying things like, you know, Kent's not interested in anything that I'm interested in. He doesn't want to do anything that I want to do. He doesn't want to talk to me about any of the stuff I want to talk about. And my sponsor said, all right, I want you to make a list of all the ways you want him to treat you. Like, that's a great list. So I made this long list of, I wanted him to treat me with respect. I wanted him to listen to me. I wanted him to do what I wanted him to do, what I wanted to do. I wanted him to go and do this stuff, and blah, 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 and all the stuff I listed. And so then she said, all right, read it to me. So I read it to him. And then she said, okay, now I want you to treat him that way. The way you want him to treat you, you treat him that way about the stuff that interests him. I'm like, no, I don't know. But what she taught me was, what that taught me was that I had to be willing to give him what I wanted him to give me, and that I got to be the example, and I needed to express some interest in what he was interested in. And as a result of that, I don't have to like the weapons, but I understand the purpose for every weapon that we have. I've also been given incredibly strict instructions not to pick up any of the weapon because I'd be more dangerous with it than without it. So when he comes to me and he says, this is what I'm thinking, I can ask him some questions. You know, okay, well, why is that different from this? And why is it that you think you need this as opposed to that? You know, how are we looking at it? What's it going to cost, kind of thing? And we can come to a place. That's, again, going back to that tradition, too, about a group conscious. By allowing him to be autonomous, and this is going to play into tradition 5 as well, by allowing him to be autonomous, I get to watch my husband grow into that man that he has become. He has grown so much from when he got sober 22 years ago. I don't know that if I told you guys this. I got here on September 18th, 1998, 22 years ago. That man that he was and that man that he is today is completely different. By the same token, the woman that I was and who I am today is completely different. I will tell you, the only thing my husband has not gotten that he's ever asked for was a kayak. And the reason for that is I knew it was an impulse buy, and I knew it would sit in the garage. And I said, you know what? If you want a kayak, we'll go rent one, but you are not getting a kayak. That's the only time I've ever said no to him about anything. We've taken some time to work through some of the stuff. And he'll still say to me, I said, have I ever said no to you? He said, well, I don't have a kayak, and you're not getting a kayak. So, but we've come to laugh about that kind of stuff. But I don't get to make the decisions for him. I want to treat my husband with respect and dignity. I want him to make his own decisions. Unless they absolutely adversely affect me, I have to be conscious and cognizant of why I am responding the way I am to whatever the decision is. And that for me is where a sponsor is critically important. I need to run this stuff by my sponsor before I talk to him about it. Because oftentimes what's coming up deep down, what I have discovered about myself is pretty much everything that drives me is fear. And there's probably some sort of fear down there that if this happens, then this will happen. And I need to work that out with my sponsor because it's not my husband's responsibility to make me feel okay. Okay. As a result of that, allowing him to grow and be who he is, allowing him to have the dignity of his actions, allowing him to make decisions that I may or may not agree with. One of the decisions he made, which was very interesting, was he decided he wanted a sports car. And I said, are you sure? And he's like, yes, I want this sports car. I've always wanted a sports car. And I said, fine. And so we bought this sports car. What we discovered is my husband is 5'5". I am 5'1½". Sports cars are not designed for short people. They are simply not designed for short people. But he'd wanted one, so we got one. And after about a year, he came to me and he said, I made a wrong decision. He said, I can't drive in that car for more than an hour without it hurting my legs. And I said, oh, thank God, I can't sit in the car for more than an hour without it hurting my legs. And I said, what do you want to do? He said, I think we need to trade it in. I don't care what we get, but I cannot keep driving that car. And it was a very small price to pay for a very big decision for him. And my husband has gotten very, very good about researching. The impulse decisions are not impulse decisions anymore. He's done a lot. He does a lot of research. And he makes some very well-reasoned decisions. But if I had not allowed him the dignity to do that, he wouldn't have learned how to do it. So that's that autonomous thing. And not everything affects me. I mean, there may be some effects, but I would like everything. I mean, I'm selfish and self-centered, and the world revolves around me, and I could say everything affects me. If I allow it to. That idea of not taking everything personally. He's not doing it to me. He's not doing it at me. I know my husband loves me. And I know that there's not one day my husband has woken up, not one single day from when he was drinking to now, where he has woken up and said, I wonder how I can screw up Corey's life today. This is what I'm going to do. He's never done that because he loves me, because we have a relationship based on love. And I need to remember that this relationship is based on love. Which brings me to tradition 5, which is my favorite tradition of all. Every Al-Anon family group has but one purpose, to help families of alcoholics. We do this by practicing the 12 steps of AA ourselves, by encouraging and supporting our alcoholic relatives, and by welcoming and giving comfort to families of alcoholics. For any of you who've ever heard me talk, you will have heard me talk about the Djibouti in Africa. So what happened was, my husband was in the military. I told you that. My husband was kicked out of the military for alcohol rehabilitation failure. And I know that that was something that weighed heavily on him. My husband, after he got sober, went back to school and got a college education. He went to work for the Department of Defense here in Montgomery, Alabama. He has since gotten 2 degrees, and I'll talk about one of them again as I get into, well, right here on Tradition 5. He'd worked all the steps. And what happened at about 4 or 5 years sober, he started working for the Department of Defense, and they were looking at the time we were in Iraq, we were in Afghanistan. The military personnel were very, very spread very thin around the world, and they started looking for civilians to volunteer to deploy. And Kent came to me and he said, I want to volunteer to deploy. And because I had worked all the 12 steps, because I have a sponsor who I adore, who knows everything about me and knows an awful lot about my husband, I knew that this military thing, that having left the military before his enlistment was off, weighed on Kent. And I said to him, is this part of your ninth step amends? And he said, yes. And I said, okay, can I pray about it? And can I talk to my sponsor about it? And he said, yes. And I called my sponsor in a tiz. My sponsor is married to a man who's retired from the Air Force. At the time, he was an Air Force colonel. When we invaded Iraq, one of the voices you hear on the plane, in the news, you'd heard one of the pilots talking. That's actually my sponsor's husband's voice, right? So he's been deployed. He had been deployed 3 times. I called my sponsor in a tiz. Oh my God, he wants to voluntarily deploy. And she said to me, this is a very quick conversation with my sponsor. Do you practice the traditions in your marriage? And I said, you know that I did too. And she said, then what's the fifth tradition? And I read the tradition to her, particularly the part that's applicable at this in this talk is, we do this by practicing the 12 steps ourselves, by encouraging and supporting our alcoholic relatives, and by welcoming them to comfort to families of alcoholics. She said, well, if you're going to support and encourage your alcoholic relatives, how can you possibly say no? And I said, well, when you put it that way, I don't guess I can. She said, all right, love you. See you later. Bye. Click. Boom. End of the conversation. And I went back to Kent and I said, if this is something you feel like you need to do, I will support you. And he said, okay. And that was like maybe 2004, 2005, somewhere in there. And I went about doing what I was told to do, which was to focus on my recovery, to be the best me that I could be. I was sponsoring women. I was working the steps. I was in service work. I was doing all this stuff. And I'm not paying any attention to what he's doing in that regard. We're doing the financial stuff. We're working on paying all that money back. He had to do a lot of stuff different in his recovery as a result of that $42,000 in credit card debt. He'd gotten a new sponsor. He'd gotten a new home group. He was doing things differently. Where we got introduced to the spiritual disciplines of step 10, 11, and 12. And we were doing daily 10 steps. And we were exploring this conscious contact. And I say we, because if you're on this path with somebody, you can either go with them, you can be dragged with them, or you can be left behind. And we were on it together. And so we were reading all sorts of literature. We had turned our guest room into a serenity room. We put up posters and pictures of things that were important to us, mountains. On my 50th birthday, my sponsor took a picture of the sunrise at her house, framed it, and sent it to me. This is what the morning looked like when you turn 50. And I have that in the serenity room. We have all sorts of stuff we've been given over the years that are related to recovery in that serenity room. And so I'm doing all this stuff, and he's doing his stuff, and we're actually on this good path, and it's going along. And one Wednesday evening, he calls me at work and he says, Wednesday afternoon, he says, it's out of cycle. Like I said, my mother lives directly across the street from us. He said, I'm picking your mother up. We're going to dinner. Meet us at the steakhouse. And I said, okay. So we went off to the steakhouse and I got there and he says to me, I don't think I'm going to get to go. And I said, go where? What are you talking about? He said, I don't think I'm going to get to be deployed. And I went, oh, honey, I'm so sorry. It had been so long, I had forgotten he was even applying. And inside, I'm doing that little happy dance. Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo. That's this thing where they tell you now and on, you just have to be rolling. You might not actually have to do anything. Yay! I was so excited. That was on a Wednesday night. Unbeknownst to me, on Thursday, he got a call. And on Monday afternoon at about 4 o'clock at my office, I got a call from him and he said, I'm being deployed. And I said, really? And he said, yes. And I said, wow, to where? He said, Djibouti. And I said, where? he said, Africa. And I went, wow, I'm at work. Can I talk to you later about this? He's like, okay, click. I'm hung up and immediately called my sponsor. Oh my God, he's going to Africa. And she gave me some very specific directions about what I was going to do to support and encourage my alcoholic husband. And we were going to practice the steps, and I was going to take anybody who asked through the steps. That year that he was gone, I thought I was going to be this lovely little stay-at-home wife who was going to be with the dogs that we had. I was going to keep the home fires burning. I was just going to be, you know, the little old martyr sitting here not having any fun. He was going to go off and have this great time. And my sponsor gave me very specific directions. You're going to work the steps. You're going to take anybody who asks through the steps. I said I was in my purse, that got in my understanding, I'd be willing to work with anybody who asked. I'd be willing to go anywhere I was willing to go. But I didn't say it out loud because I didn't want God to actually hear me. And then she said, and you're going to find something you guys can do together while you're apart, and you're going to stay connected. And that's all, you know, the purpose is to help families of alcoholics. I do that by working the steps myself. It helps me. It helps you. You know, whenever I'm working with somebody and they're talking about something, you know, something that's going on with them, I said, you know, God is not going to give something to you and punish somebody else. That's not the way the God of my understanding works. If it's good for you, it's good for them. It's good for them. It's going to be good for you. Why would God only help one of two people? That doesn't make any sense. That's not the God of my understanding. So if I'm going to do that, I'm going to work the steps myself. I'm going to support and encourage my alcoholic husband. If that means I'm going to stay at home and keep the home fires burning, then that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to give comfort to families of alcoholics. I was not allowed to isolate inside myself. It's amazing to me. Once I said that prayer and once we knew Kent was going, I started getting asked to go and speak places, and people started being willing to come with me. I took sponsees to stuff. I started getting on planes. I started going. As a result of that, that year was phenomenal. It was difficult. It was not as difficult as the first year my husband was sober, but it was difficult. And so many things happened. You know, up until that point, he left in August of 2010 for his deployment. And up until that point, there was still something in me that said I was not enough. It was not as great as it was when I got here. When I got here, I knew I was not enough. I was not tall enough. I was not skinny enough. I was not cute enough. I was not funny enough. I was not smart enough. I was not dumb enough. I was not enough. But by the time he got ready to be deployed, I knew that I was pretty much okay enough. I wasn't enough, but I was almost enough, if that makes sense. And he came home on August 10th and said, I have to be in Djibouti on August 31st. And they're putting me on a plane in 10 days. And I had 10 days to get ready to send my husband halfway around the world to do this deployment for a year. And I was not enthused. Let me just put it that way. I knew it was something he had to do. And I will tell you what came back to me was the fear. The fear was one more time he was going to get there and he was going to have this great time. And then he was not going to want to come home to me in Wetumpka. That it was going to be too boring, and really wished he had done something different. And that was my fear. And I actually said the fear out loud to my sponsor. And my sponsor said, give that to God and be about your own recovery. And so I put him on a plane on August 29th, August 30th, something like that. And 2 days later, I had to be in Nashville, Tennessee to speak at a conference. It wasn't my intention. It was just what ended up happening. And so I ended up in this conference. And Kent called me. It was a Thursday night when I got there. Kent called me and he said, I have just landed in Djibouti, Africa. It's like 110 degrees and I am in a tent with 65 guys. And I said, oh, honey, it sucks to be you. I am in a junior suite with chocolate covered strawberries. Have a good evening. But the next day I got a phone call from somebody and they said, the women in Alcoholics Anonymous told me I needed to call you and ask you to take me through the steps. And what started happening was people started coming out of the woodwork. Will you take me through the steps? Will you come and speak here? Will you come and do this? Will you do that? Will you do this? And what it did was it kept me absolutely connected to you. And it allowed me to be excited about my husband. I didn't sit at home and wallow in self-pity. I was able to allow him to have the excitement and the adventure that he was having. He was posting pictures. I will tell you this. One of the things he said to us that we had to do, when my sponsor said, find something you guys can do together but apart, I made the mistake of telling Kent that. And he said, scuba diving. And I said, I am afraid of being underwater. And he said, scuba diving. Because he heard then what he always hears when he doesn't want to hear what I'm saying, which is wah, 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 wah. He actually said to me this morning as we came back from walking, he said, I need to make an amends to you. I don't think I listened to you and I let the cat out of the bag about a Christmas gift you bought your mother. I'm like, lovely. So that's okay. I was going to talk to her about that. I bought my mother a jacket and I didn't know if it fit her. And I was going to talk to her about it today. He said, I told her it on Thursday. She had already bought herself the jacket. So she's returned it and she's supposed to pretend to be excited when you tell her about it. So I went over and told my mother, it's okay, fine. But it's that idea of him not listening to me. And he didn't listen to me about the scuba diving. And I called my sponsor and I said, he wants me to learn to scuba dive. And she said, learn to scuba dive. I said, I'm afraid of being underwater. And my sponsor, God love her, she said, okay, well, take God with you. Learn to scuba dive, click, and hung up. I'm like, how do they learn this stuff, man? Is there like some sponsor workshop they all go to or they email each other? Ooh, say this the next time. But she said, do it afraid, take God with you. And so I went and signed up for, can't call me. I thought, there's no way there's going to be scuba diving in Djibouti, Africa. I mean, it's Africa, for God's sake. Djibouti is on the eastern side. It's a very, 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 very poor country, one of the poorest in the world. There is not going to be scuba diving in Djibouti, Africa. Well, if you know anything about scuba diving, it is the number one place on the planet to scuba dive with whale sharks. And it's probably the number two most beautiful place on the planet to scuba dive, period. I did not know that. So on Sunday night, he calls me and says, my first scuba diving lesson is tonight. When is yours? And I went, oh, crap, I guess it's Wednesday. And I signed up for scuba diving lessons. And I went and I learned to scuba dive. I will tell you, the first day, the first lesson, I pulled up into the parking lot of the scuba diving place. And I turned around to the seat next to me. And I said, okay, God, apparently we're going to learn to scuba dive. Try not to let me die. And obviously, he did not let me die. And I learned to scuba dive. I walked through my fear and I learned to scuba dive. And as a result of doing that, my husband could come home once in the year that he was gone. Let me correct that. They would fly him anywhere in the world where it costs as much or less than to fly home. And he said to me, I'm a huge photographer. And he said, I know what Wetumpka, Alabama looks like. I would really like for us to fly you here, not to Djibouti, but to Tanzania. And I'd like us to do a photo safari. That's what I would like us to do. He got 15 days to do it. And I said, yes. And so they flew him to Tanzania. He met me in Tanzania. I flew. It's not easy to get to Tanzania, in case you're wondering. I went Montgomery, Atlanta, Dulles, which is Washington, D.C., Amsterdam, Tanzania, Arusha, Tanzania. And we spent 15 days in Tanzania and we did a photo safari. It was just he and I. And it was the most incredible experience we've ever had together. It was a trip of a lifetime. And we had a ball. We spent 10 days in country in the national parks in Tanzania. And then we flew from Tanzania to Zanzibar and we went scuba diving in the Indian Ocean. It was incredible. And I'd have missed it all if I had not walk through my fear. You know, and I don't think the program says to me, if you work this program hard enough, you will not have fear. What this program says to me, if you do what we ask you to do, you don't have to do any of it alone. You can walk through your fear and you can have an experience that you never imagined. And it was incredible. It was absolutely incredible. And when I got home from that, when I left him and I knew it was another 6 months before I'd see him again, and I got home and I was got home on a Saturday evening and I sat on my couch and I sobbed. I hate Al-Anon. I hate AA. If it wasn't for that stupid Al-Anon, I'd have never said yes. If it wasn't for that stupid AA, he would never have gone. I hate it. Just sobbing. I knew two things. One, I was incredibly jet lagged, and so I didn't need to answer the phone. And two, if anybody called me the next day, I did need to answer the phone because I didn't need to isolate. I stayed up long enough to hit about 7 o'clock. I ate a lot of chocolate and I went to bed. And when I woke up the next morning, I had people calling saying, how was it? Was it great? I had photographs. It was wonderful because I knew I needed to stay connected to you guys. But that's the thing. I needed to be willing to support and encourage my alcoholic husband. That's not the only time I've had to do that. When he got sober, he wanted to go back to school. And we looked at the finances. We looked if we could do it. And I said, yes. And so he went back to school. We paid for it ourselves. When he got back from Djibouti, after he'd been that year away and we were doing some stuff, he had said to me, maybe a year after he got back, he said, I think I want to go back to school. One of the things my husband discovered about himself when he got sober was he likes to learn, loves to read. He said, I think I'd like to go back to school. And I said, okay, what do you want to go back to school in? And he said, well, I'd either want to go back to school in history or get a divinity degree. And I said, all right, well, tell me, because you've taught me how to do this. Tell me why you'd get a history degree. He said, so I could do something with it. I could teach history. Do you want to teach history? Well, no, but I think I have to be able to do something with it. And I said, all right. Why would you get a divinity degree? And he said, because I want to learn about God. I think I have a lot of old ideas about God from the way I was raised, and I want to learn about God. He said, but I couldn't do anything with that degree. I said, okay. I said, well, let's pray about it. Let's think about it. And we were actually off on our way to church at that time. And we went through church, came back, and I said to him, because I've learned to practice the traditions, tradition one, tradition two, a common welfare, group conscience, tradition five, support and encourage, autonomy. What is it that you want to do? I said to him, you're talking yourself off the path before you've even explored it. If what you really want to do is learn about God, go find a program that you want to learn about God. You don't have to have an ulterior. That's a good enough reason. That's what you want to do. I'll support it. And he came home, and I am not kidding you. Within 24 hours, he'd found an online program. He had been accepted to it, and he could start in 2 weeks. And I said to him, if that's not an indication of the God of your understanding putting you in a direction, I don't know what is. Go for it. And so he did this. He did this program, and it did not take him where either one of us thought it was going to take him. What it did was it opened his mind. And I don't know if you've ever been with somebody who is going through a graduate program, but you can either participate or you can be bored out of your skull. And I decided to participate. And so what we ended up doing was he was reading all these books. I was reading the books with him. We were having this, I mean, it just opened up everything. And at the end of this program, he called his sponsor up and he said, oh my God, I think I'm spiritually confused. And his sponsor said, no, you're a spiritual omnivore. You take it all in. And that's that idea of developing a relationship with the God of your understanding. Take everything in and develop your own relationship. And that's what we have both done. And I will tell you, the God of my understanding doesn't look exactly like the God of his understanding, and that is okay. It's absolutely okay. But we expanded our horizons, right? So moving on to tradition six. Our Al-Anon family groups never endorse, finance, or lend our name to any outside enterprise. These problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary spiritual aim. Although a separate entity, we should always cooperate with Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to scroll through this and see if somebody is on here who might have been on here. I was at a conference a couple of years ago. That's not true. I was at a conference 5 years ago. It was in August. And I was speaking with a gal there, and we just clicked. We just clicked, and we spent the weekend together chatting, and we were at the airport together waiting to go our separate ways. And she asked me, she said, you know, I'm looking at this tradition six, and it talks about diverting us from our primary spiritual aim. And she said, what's your primary spiritual aim? And I instantly answered, to love and be loving. Actually, that's not true. I lied to you. I answered, to be of maximum service to God and to my fellows. And I said, what is your primary spiritual aim? And she said, to love and be loving. And I said, isn't it really two different sides of the same coin? And she said, yeah. And we started talking about how do I fulfill my primary spiritual aim and be of maximum service to God and to my fellows? And what does that look like? How do I do that? How do I participate in my own life? And she was talking about being loving. What does that mean? Well, it means practicing these traditions by allowing our loved ones to be autonomous. Yes, I will do a break after, as soon as I finish this, what I'm talking about here. To not allow problems of money, property, and prestige to divert us from our primary spiritual aim. For me, it's the money. You know, not allow the fear of the money to not divert us. Not so much the prestige anymore. And the property, I'll get back to the money. My primary spiritual aim is to be maximum service to God and to my fellows. How do I do that? By showing up, by being present, by knowing that it's not about the money, it's not about the property, it's not about the prestige. It's about being a loving partner in my relationship with my husband. This summer, the whole COVID thing, it's been very interesting. When we started in March and everything went on lockdown here in March, and Kent and I both started teleworking. Prior to that point, Kent and I, as a result of all the financial stuff, we ended up hiring, we paid off all that debt. We got on the same page financially, and we started talking about retirement and got to a place where, having hired a financial planner, he said we could retire at 60, which for Kent was 2 years in May. It was 60. It'll be May 2022. For me, it's October 2022. So I'm just now under the 2 year mark of retirement. And when we went to the COVID and we were working from home, I made a little bit of hesitation about how were we going to do being at home together in retirement. And what COVID has done is given me a wonderful opportunity to see we're going to be great. It's going to be fantastic. We're going to have a great time. But Kent has really struggled with work as a result of working from home. It's been very, very difficult for him. And he came to me in August and said, I don't know that I can do this anymore. And I said, okay, what do you mean? And he said, it's awful. I am miserable. It is awful. Can I retire now? And I said, well, I don't know. Let's take a look at that. And it's because I have these traditions and I do not want to let the problems of money, property, or prestige influence my decisions. They said, let me take a look at it. And so we did. I came home, we looked at it, we talked about it. And I said, yes, you are eligible to retire. But if you retire, it's going to change what retirement looks like, because you'll go 2 years early. It's going to have some financial implications for us. And he said, can we do it? He said, yes, we can do it, but it's going to have some implications. I don't care. I'll do whatever. Like, all right. So go start the paperwork. So he went and he submitted the paperwork, and then he talked to his bosses, and then he brought home the paperwork. He said, this is what it's going to be. And I said, you have the wrong code in there. Go back and change the code. And so he went back and he changed the code, and he came home. He said, do you see how much money this is going to cost us? And I said, I'm aware of that. In between that, his bosses had said, can we talk to you before you make a decision? And he said, yes. So he had the paperwork that he saw in black and white, and he went and he talked to his bosses and he told them what was going on. And he came home and he said, I'm so grateful that you were willing that we would to allow me to do that if we needed to. But I don't believe it's in the best interest of our family. I don't think the common welfare is such that we should make that financial decision. It's going to be too big of a hit. It's me not being willing to do what I need to do. There are other things I can do. I am not retiring, and I've withdrawn my retirement papers. Whew. But the kicker of that is my husband is applying these traditions. He doesn't even realize he's applying them in the way in which he's acting, because I'm being an example of how to do that, if that makes any sense. We did the same thing when it came to my dream job was to be a judge, and I wanted that position badly, and I did everything I needed to do to get to that position. And when I didn't get the last position a few years ago, I said to Kent, that's okay, another position will come open in a couple of years. And my husband had the courage to say to me, I'd like you to think about not doing that. And I said, what? Why? He said, well, because I know you'd feel compelled to work long enough to get the retirement, to commit to the job for the period that would be required, which will put us in Alabama at the age of 70. And I don't want to be in Alabama at 70. I want us to be retired and live out west someplace. And I said, can I think about it, pray about it, and talk to my spouse about it? And he said, yes. And we came back to the place of the only reason I would apply for it again is for the prestige. To be able to say that I'd hit that mark in my career, didn't need to do it financially. It'd be a lovely boost financially, but we don't need the money. How much is enough? That theory of abundance. And it was more important to me. The primary purpose for me and our common welfare was for me to be with my husband in retirement at the age of 60. And I'm going to go back to at the end of that year that Kent was deployed. I cannot tell you when it happened. I cannot tell you how it happened, but I can tell you that it did happen. The end of that year, I realized that in and of myself, I am enough. I am absolutely enough. If Kent made the decision he needed to go, it'd break my heart, but it would not break my soul. If I didn't ever become a judge, it wouldn't even break my heart. It would be fine. And that's a direct result of me working through the program of Al-Anon, applying these traditions in my life and continuing to do what you guys have taught me to do. Yvonne says we're going to take a break. It is 12:43 according to my clock. We'll come back at 1 o'clock, which I don't know what time that is in California. I will tell you I'm only going to go to 12. I'm not going to go to 12:45 because by the time I hit 12, I'm going to be hoarse and I'll be done. So, Yvonne, you're up.